farthest place they went, basically.
Okay, okay. So let us. Even though a lot of people aren't here yet. I think you all should know, if you don't, that Monday is a holiday, President's Day, so there will be no workshops, no workshop activities. Another important thing is next week, on the 21st, we're going to have, Sarah Voss, can you sit up front? One of the, say in this chair or that chair, whichever Jordy's not in. We're going to have a start at 1:15, because we have to finish by cookie time, which is 3:15. I just found out I was going to be the moderator today, and Jordy, I just found out 2 seconds ago, is going to be the recorder. So I think that's good in general to have the moderator separate from the recorder, especially since I'm the moderator. So he is the recorder, it's no longer a question. And so the 5 speakers this week are sitting in front of you.
So we cannot see what's being recorded.
Yeah, well, you can look around. You can turn your turn around and see. Right. And so there is no particular plan for this, except if the speakers have things they wanted to say and didn't get a chance, or the rest of us had questions for them we didn't get a chance to ask, we'll ask now and see where it goes. So, who would like to start with the topic? I mean, when Suzanne asked for them last week, she got 2, I think. But I think this is more efficient. And everybody doesn't have to go read the wiki again. So. Also, by the way, Suzanne, I believe, will not be here today. I don't know if she's going to be around. I don't know exactly when she's leaving. And Roman will not come to the meeting until next Tuesday. So there's a void where you can do anything you want and call it.
You said Monday is holiday.
So Monday's a holiday, yes. Roman comes Tuesday. But I don't know what time he comes on Tuesday, whether he comes. Okay. If he's flying down from. Is he at ITAM now?
No, he's in Vancouver.
Okay. Where is he?
Vancouver.
Vancouver, yeah, okay. So he just has to fly down from Vancouver, but he wouldn't get here before the afternoon, anyway, if he flies down that morning. So, topics, questions, who would like to?
Unfortunately, I had to leave the joint discussion with the career and control people. Wanted to say something because I remember the early meetings of the Cold Molecule community, which were actually joint meetings with the Courier and Control people. So if you really are interested to talk to us about that, I'm happy to.
Does anybody know? I mean, there was a comment about Calarco saying that Blatt had 150 qubits.
Who?
That Tom Calarco had made a comment, and I guess in the other meeting, that Blatt had achieved a 150 qubit device, you want. And I don't know anything about it. Does anybody here know about it?
I know that he was building a trap, very
so
elongated
is it a
one.
Linear
but
iron
yes,
trap?
In this sense, but maybe he has 150 iron, but I don't know if he has operated them really.
150 is really substantially more than he had actually last spring when I heard him speak at Harvard at the Ramsey Symposium, Memorial Symposium, where he had something like 50, if I remember, an order of magnitude here. And he was actually asked by somebody in the audience what his feelings are about the implementation of a quantum computer platform and with the carry out. And he mentioned to say in 5 years. So
okay.
He made an order of magnitude improvement in 1 year.
Well, no, the last things I heard of him were 70 ions. Maybe 15 he meant really working on them. Because that's the difference. One thing is trapping them and the other is working with them.
Right. Well,
we can look it up. As long as he did not talk about years rather than.
Yeah. I don't know how old he is. Maybe he's thinking when he will retire, and then he says, before I retire, I have to have it done.
Among all these proposals,
atomic ions.
Atomic ions, yes, exactly. That's what he's doing.
It's capability issue.
And I would like to better understand actually the difference between the proposal of quantum computer platform based on trapped ions and based on trapped molecules. So I don't, and you know, people are pursuing both.
It looks like that the ions are much easier to trap, they're kind of getting longer, and so on. So
it's more coherent, but it's less scalable, I think, those things.
I think it's
of the molecules, because you cannot make well, as far as my naive understanding of this goes, like, you can make a long optical lattice, but you cannot make like a huge crystal or something.
Space charge patients or something like that. I understand correctly, but not very.
What people would actually do is scale up.
But you can build like not 50 ions, but 5,000 ions.
And maybe you can do it two or three dimensional rather than one dimensional.
So just to go from like toy things to real quantum computer, which is, I think that's why people are playing with like solid state devices, for example.
My opinion is that I don't think, one computer that is useful here, there, for you to carry your cell phone, it's going to come from solid state, not atom physics. Okay, atom physics for
but
me.
But I think no one is thinking in having a quantum laptop. That's not the point with computers.
Yeah, they will have some facility based on.
I mean, you have to think in not in 20 years old, but 80 or 100 years old. With the first computers, it was big machines to calculate how a projectile flies, or maybe a bit of the weather for tomorrow, and that's what you can expect to do nowadays with quantum computers, if you build one.
I don't think you can project right now what's going to win.
Yes.
Exactly.
So the idea that kind of taking from today's computers, move like and do like needs to be continuously performing operations for hours on end. That's just going to be necessary in Microsoft's system.
And the quantum mechanics really implies perfection. Solid state doesn't usually imply.
Well, it kind of does. I mean, like Misha Lukin did one second coherence time at room temperature.
I understand. I'm just saying, when you talk to a condensed matter physicist, they're always interested in the defects. Okay? It's not perfect in the sense that an optical lattice can be very nearly perfect.
In any case, I don't want a computer with 1 second of memory. When I save a file, I want it to stay there for longer than a second.
Silicon.
That's what I mean. I mean, I don't see a laptop.
Like picosecond. Yeah. Would call it
anyway, we will not solve that issue today.
Yes. But in this sense, maybe one should say that. I think yesterday appeared three papers in Nature, I think. It's not quantum computation, but they do something speeding up, not only a kind of calculation. It's boson, I don't remember now, but it's with photons, this thing with circuits and so on, so it's something of determining the determinant of a matrix in a very efficient way. So, but it's not a quantum computer, they insist in that, but it relies on quantum physics. So we might have interesting results before having.
Yeah, I mean, we might, for example, invite Calarco to talk next Friday at this group and see if he could pursue that. Right.
Wasn't this guy Keynes actually also the one who showed that the quantum computer based on NMR actually worked? Was it Black and
I think you're right. Yeah, I think that's right.
I have seen his name on one of the doors, but I don't know him. So.
Right.
I think he's one of the authors of one of these three papers.
But this microwave circuitry is very well developed now. But I think they also have issues with scalability.
Yeah, but I think were not microwaves. I think they were optical photons, but that's the waveguides. But anyway, maybe I am not the moderator, but we are drifting from cold molecules.
We are drifting, yes.
Yeah, but the question was whether there was an advantage of cold molecules for quantum computing over ions, right? And isn't there a difference also in speed, in operational speed, with the ions you couple? internal state and motion state?
Well, you can also not do that. I mean, that's these fast gates that I mentioned in my presentation. Yeah. You can do with I mean, it's with ions. The initial proposal is with ions, atomic ions. So it doesn't really rely on the structure. You can also do that.
You think there's not really an issue of that there can be speed of using ions or
no? I think what could be an interesting advantage for quantum information or quantum simulation of quantum matter would be if it can be more robust against experimental uncertainties or things. So maybe in this sense, the fact that the spectrum of molecules typically is very complex and anharmonic and so on might help in the sense that you can be sure to access a state and all the others will, I mean, you will not have multiphoton. I don't know what you think about this.
Okay, well, let's focus on the five talks we heard this week and see if there's some suggestions. I mean, I have some questions I can ask, but I thought I'd open the floor first.
In the internal.
Right.
By the double.
Right.
Yeah, in this sense, maybe the advantage could be that you can switch on and off the interaction, switching on and off the dipole moment, while the ions are always talking by Coulomb.
Exactly.
So there you need to rely on the motion.
Okay. So they're asking the differences.
I mean, the dipole.
The paper,
yeah. I mean, if you talk about dipolar ions, then the Coulomb, the charges will overwhelm the dipole, and it's. But the internal states are still useful. But you could get those from hyperfine or fine structure or something else. They don't have to come from the rotational spectrum.
Well, in this case, you will separate like the trappable degree of freedom and so the degree of freedom you're working with, right?
Right.
So
right.
you don't mess with coherence times,
right,
due to like optical lattice or something.
Right.
So what's the highest temperature of the world of ions?
What is the what?
So what is the highest temperature you can work in the
Oh, you can have very deep ion traps.
Yeah, but coherence times are more.
Right, right.
Like if you use your two hyperfine states to address quantum memory or something like how reliable would it be to build a quantum computer at room temperature or like a Kelvin temperature or something? So, well, I don't think it would be possible. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but
there's
no
about the talks that we had this week. Crystal, questions on crystal issues, conflicts, problems.
Well, I mean, there were two things at the end of Misha's talk that he referred to, his field sensing and also the quadrupole Fermi experiments. I wonder, I think those are both interesting topics. You didn't have time to discuss them.
Okay, so we'll give another two talks.
No. I want a 5-minute maximum blackboard.
Yeah, so. yeah, so it was in.
So the field sensing first.
Yeah, field sensing actually was with Roman and a great student of his, Sergei Labushev. So the idea is actually very simple. So, you know, people do atomic magnetometers. So what they do, they have some, say, two hyperfine states in rubidium, like in the ground state. So they prepare all the atoms in this hyperfine state. Then they have some microwave strip line or something they want to image. So they put like, well, microwave strip line, they put like an atomic cloud there, it expands out of the trap, and then the microwave field of the strip line drives the radio oscillations here. It's like a B component of the electromagnetic field. And then they image this state, so they measure the population after some time, and so they calculate the intensity, like two-dimensional distribution of strength of some microwave field.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, well, it was done by Hensch and Philip Teutlein, who was his group leader, and Philip told me that actually it wasn't like some fancy application of atoms they just cooked out. So they really wanted to measure microwave field distribution in some settings. So we really needed that. And it worked out perfectly. And so the idea is that, well, molecules can have a dipole moments, well, not only magnetic dipole moments, but electric dipole moments. And if you interact with an electric field component of some electromagnetic field, it will be like speed of light times stronger, right? It will be like 137 times stronger. So you immediately gain two orders of magnitude there. And also, well, molecules are more versatile in the sense that you can have molecules with different rotational constants. You can apply fields and tune different avoided crossings and so on. And in atoms, well, you cannot make the splitting smaller than the hyperfine splitting, and you cannot make it larger than, say, half a gigahertz. So you cannot apply like an infinite magnetic field to tune it. So it turns out that with molecules, you can play with different like rotational states and like apply fields to bring them closer. And it's possible to actually measure both electric and magnetic fields, like both DC and oscillating fields from like 100 hertz to like terahertz. Like if you take a very light molecule like NH, it will have a huge, like almost terahertz level splitting, and then these oscillations will drive this transition. So the idea is that. And so numerics, Sergey did show that, well, it works.
But okay. The problem is the detection
of the
mark. It's
not a problem at all, because for atoms, they measure ions. So the ion stuff, and they just measure a two-dimensional distribution. For molecules, you do the same, you do like Rampe or something, so you just ionize, like do resonance-enhanced multiple ionization. So you don't need to scatter photons, that's not LIF.
Right, and if you have two levels that are very close together, you can't resolve by Rampe, then you can do a double resonance experiment quite easily and then get that additional resolution.
Ion imaging is really, really like established. And like Dave Chandler, other people like Mark Bullard are doing this scattering experiment.
Hundreds of people.
Yeah, that's very, very low loaded technique.
They weren't actually particularly well suited for light range.
Well, they kind of span different kind of ranges. If you take calcium fluoride or calcium hydride, well, come on, the molecules that are being trapped, right? It will be like a bit heavier, and then it will be like smaller frequencies, and then. So in principle, it can, like, if you play a lot of field, it will span a wide range, but it won't be as efficient as in some narrow range, right? So this region of 100 hertz to terahertz was possible to span with like three molecules. It was calcium fluoride, something like OH, I think, and then, something in the middle, so forth.
And just a quick comment is that, you know, reducing those splittings, if you go back to our discussion last week of the OH, where you have this denominator, which is a splitting, to stabilize, that might be very interesting in combination with the very small splittings you can achieve with many molecules.
Yeah, well, we have kind of an email exchange with June now. Not on OH, but like Bertislav mentioned this work, like using a laser field. Like laser fields can go, it doesn't jeopardize states of the opposite parity, but it creates very close lambda doublets, like artificial kind of lambda doublets.
Right.
And then, well, in principle, you can do this trick and even make like one over R R cubed potential. In principle.
Right.
Yeah, it's tricky what intensities do you need, but with magnetic field, you can also do that in principle.
So have you found some particularly interesting examples for June?
Well, it's tricky to do with KRP, of course.
Yeah.
Magnetic fields might be possible.
In the triplet state.
Kirk
Madison's going to talk about making triplet molecules next Tuesday, and I'm going to talk Wednesday morning about making triplet states also. In both KRB and RB2.
How old would they be?
Nobody knows. Probably seconds. I don't know.
It's like because they decay by some hyperfine couplings?
Well, there could, in some cases, they're near resonant with the singlet state, and then the hyperfine will couple. But nobody's done a good calculation of how long they live.
It's not a piece of cake, I believe.
No, it's not a piece of cake. Maybe he's got one. Somebody. So the other topic was quadrupole Fermi gases.
Yeah, so quadrupole, it was a pleasure to collaborate with Erhai Jal here.
Yeah.
We finally met, so it's only one author of the paper that I have to meet. So the idea is kind of very simple, and so like Susanna and I like thought about that, and then we collaborated with people doing a great job in many body physics. So the thing is that, well, polar molecules, they are hard to prepare, they collapse, like they react, and so many people work with homonuclear molecules, and as a matter of fact, if you have a homonuclear molecule, it looks like, well, it looks like a cigar or something. Like if you prepare it in some state with like J larger than like 1/2, in general, it will be like J plus 1, or any other non-spherical state, it will have a substantial value of a quadrupole. Also, you can do this with alkaline earth atoms, like metastable calcium, strontium, or like ytterbium, which is not alkaline earth, but have the same level structure. So if you prepare it in this triplet P states, mm-hmm. it's like a color forbidding transition, and they live like for hundreds of minutes. So it's basically forever, right?
Well, the triplet P1 is not, but the triplet P0 and P2 are long.
Yeah, sure. It's like the SS forbiddenness. And people did like degenerate Fermi gases of strontium, and all the condensated strontium, and everything. And well, in this case, we studied like a many body behavior of Fermi system, and also like the good question is like how the hell can you create like a fermionic homonuclear molecule?
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, what people do for the association of different isotopes, right? And, well, when I talk to people, they will say, like, why? Like, we never did much of it, like, to create fermions because nobody cared, but in principle, it's not a problem. Like, rubidium 8587 right. produced and so on.
The other point is if you have the homonuclear case, you have ortho and para.
Yeah.
You have two different species.
Yeah. Well, we also thought, like, it might be more robust in, well, especially like what interests Susanna as far as I understand, like quantum information of polar molecules, and
yeah.
This state would live not for seconds, but they will live forever, right? So like if you have this rotational state 0, 1, 2 in a molecule, okay, they will decay at some point, like in seconds, but if you don't even have these states and the molecule doesn't have any dipole moment, and if you excite it somehow by a random transition to this state, yeah. it will just decay like never, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
10 to the 7th or 10 to the 9th or something like that.
It will be really, really
they've been calculated for H2 accurately, the quadrupole transitions. I don't remember the number, but I think it's 10 to the 7th, 10 to the 9th, something like that. Let me just comment, even for KRB, if you look at the lowest rotational level, I think that is approximately 10 to the 7th seconds already. To go from J equal 1 to J equal 0.
Yeah, well,
because the dipole moment is relatively small.
Like if you calculate it's like using this like omega cube dependence of spontaneous emission, right? It's extremely small and it's right. like 10 to the 7th, but, well, I mean, you know better, but the experimentalists told me that, well, maybe like in the lab it would be like seconds realistically, so it won't be.
We actually have a paper in JChem Phys which does the calculation for all the vibrational levels and a few of the rotational levels of KRB, and those are the, it's kiloseconds for vibrational levels. That's the shortest lifetime.
But collisions can.
Oh, yeah, that doesn't include collisions. I'm talking about radiative lifetime.
What would accelerate, actually, the relaxation?
Like scattering of photons?
So would it be black body photons?
Oh, black body photons. Well, like in general, if you scatter far off resonance photons, there'll be like an well, how it's called. There is a formula of name that sometimes people. But if you scatter some extremely far off resonance photons, which is like an optical lattice, so there will be like virtual transitions via everything, and you will like imagine the part of the polarizability basically. Well, as far as I understand, but it's been calculated that black body will also be there, and like, depends on temperature. Some noise of electrical field or something.
So what is the status then of this project on quadrupolar?
It's we resubmitted their bottle for reference comments.
Okay.
So hopefully it will appear at some point, and yeah, it's, well, the preprint should also play like Flora and Shrek or excited if like people got a bit enthusiastic because well, they like common nuclear molecules.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Christoph Nagel and other people.
Sure.
And hopefully they will test these predictions in experiments, or at least some of those. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is that like the quadruple interactions, if you plot them, they have like a sine oscillating pattern, which is more like more frequent sign changing compared to dipoles, and so it results in very rich phase diagrams. Mm-hmm. So the guys calculated with functional normalization group. So you have like a lot of like five phases meeting at some point, and mm-hmm. well, depending on the angle of alignment of quadrupoles mm-hmm. with respect to like to some optical lattice. Mm-hmm. And so you can have some playground to test some.
How do you align that?
Well, so
depends on a dipole, I know how to align.
Well, it's a good question. So in principle, you don't even need a field to do that. So in principle, if you prepare a state, say, like J equals 2, M equals 2, or M equals 0, so this state will look like, or M equals 0 will look like something like, well, I'm a very good artist, like this, or like M equals 2, some donut, and these things will already have a quadrupole. So basically, what you need is to split the levels a little bit with some field, which is weak enough to induce any like dipole moment or something, and then you just make a transition. And if you have if you select some M state, it will have a quadrupole.
You need the field to define this axis, and then what is the splitting? I mean, how are they split? Because you will have to compare this with the typical energy.
Well, in principle, in principle, it's not a, like if you take even like a, I know, like a magnetic atom, say, and you can prepare it in M equals zero state, which is not magnetic, right? And J equals zero, like so, you won't have like magnetic dipole interaction, but they will be like quadrupole interaction. Well, in principle, like polarization of your light will define, like even without splitting them, you can prepare a definite state. Because polarization, like linear or circular polarization.
So selection rule. Selection rule.
Yeah, exactly. It will define already the quantization. So you're going from J equals 0 to 0.
Okay, thanks. Some other comments, questions, topics?
Was quite interesting, the two approaches that we had here, kind of many body kind of thing, that one was more talking of fermions and the other, you, Robert, talking more of bosons. I don't know to what extent you think that the methods are very similar, or one could use one approach for the other system, or I mean, your approach is very specific to fermions, or you could use that for bosons also.
Detailed analysis of the two-body problem in order to describe many-body physics.
But you think that could, so it can be applied to, as you say,
yeah.
It doesn't rely on the statistics.
Right. Yeah. I think apply more generally. But, you know, taking that Hamiltonian that was my last slide and applying it to many-body physics right now is something on the horizon that's always
I think it would be interesting there also that there are also other approaches for looking at strong interactions, special photons in an optical lattice. And one of the people who is coming, I think, next week, or maybe week after, Alejandro Sanz from Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
I think he has quite some papers now on how to treat this coupling between center of mass motion and relative motion. And he extended this to several sites now. And I think he gets quite some, you know, like a mess of curves on all this. But it would be interesting to compare maybe your method to what he did, because it's like a different approach, but it should In terms of this privacy.
Yeah, and including, I think, the way he does explicitly, I mean, the lab is a few sites, 2-3 sites I have seen that he has done, right?
Yeah, that's right. We've done ourselves a few years ago a very simple approach. It was for comparison with an experiment that Immanuel Bloch did on helium and that is spin-off physics, where you saw its oscillations. Mm-hmm. And this was also coupling between relative motion and center of mass. But we did a first order approach there, which basically accounts for the anemonic correction, because the latitude is, you know, not very deep, but still sufficiently deep. And then you also get shifts of energy levels. Here you can, in principle, treat the interaction strength exact, because we use there this Thomas Busch model, and there you have the function of 1 upon A, and you look at the eigenenergies through the threshold of elements, and this is in principle, you know, an exact approach, in this case. But then the lattice is only a harmonic term, and then the first order of calculation, you can actually calculate the first order of the shift. That would be quite simple way to compare people.
So there's two limits are the Hubbard model, right? And in some sense, that's circular reasoning because we use that model to benchmark the Hubbard model of this computer's work. And that's sort of the asymptotically small S-wave scattering length regime. And then there's the harmonic oscillator, which would be the extremely deep lattice regime. And the bound state should always lie above an energy. And that should asymptotically get closer as the lattice becomes deeper. Sure, right. All the block bands overlap and you have no bound states in the continuum, which is now actual continuum and kind of single bound state. Looks like a very cool.
Yeah, I think that
we
it's
an interesting question. I mean, a lot of the focus on many-body physics with AMO systems has been on how to make AMO systems look like condensed matter systems. But there's also a lot of interest in what sort of many-body systems arise naturally for.
Like spin crystals with long-range interactions.
Sure.
It doesn't exist in nature.
Right, it doesn't exist in nature. But, you know, also the question of when you just have a very strongly correlated or strongly interacting atomic system, it might not look like the Hubbard model, right? But it doesn't have to in order to be interesting, right? We don't have to sort of make our models look like things that can explain.
In principle, it's not, I mean, it's all this dipolar business.
Well,
as far as you know this better, right? So the long-range interactions never occur in, like, real crystals as far as
they're always screened.
Sort of like they're always screened in, like, nearest neighbor surfaces to describe this. So I think all this business is motivated by, like, pure interest.
Sure. And even the Hubbard model is not a good description of kinetic matter, right? But everyone wants to make things look like the Hubbard model because it's the Hubbard model.
Yeah, because you can
solve
the Hubbard model.
Yeah, right.
Oh, but even if you solve it really well, nobody cares.
But especially, I mean, this system is especially because since the moment that we have optical lattices, you can make these artificial crystals. But it's also interesting the systems without the lattice, but it's in the continuum that you can have self-ordering like these crystals that is really, I don't know, different from condensed matter. It's interesting to explore.
But I think there's a lot fundamentally we can learn about many-body physics,
right,
without having to know anything about it.
Hopefully, because I don't know much. And mainly these works were on, well, let's say two particle problem in the, so looking the effect of the lattice and so on. For three body, the people have also, well, I remember your talk was mainly also without the track, right?
Yes.
But they, someone has looked at this kind of free body Efimov in quotation marks in the last.
Three electron recombination in solids or something like
that? I think that the case for solid for the solid.
Crystals.
So 114 is halfway to the clock.
Yeah, yeah. So this is, what's this? This is a way of scaling between the bulk and the small cluster in the limit one, in which there's no binding energy.
So for what? For what?
Anything. For helium, for helium,
copper clusters, CO2 clusters, argon clusters, and alpha particle clusters, also known as nuclei.
But it's all
it's linear.
Okay.
You can start at two, or you can start at
linear.
What? N is the number of particles in the cluster. So it's helium, N, those are quantum Monte Carlo calculations from Kalos and Fishman.
Okay. I also did something.
What's that?
I think
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, this was in 86, though. Yeah, this is an old reference. But yeah, I mean, there, I haven't gone through the literature in this few body to many body area to try to see if there are other things that work, but I thought I would point that out. This was Manuel Deano, who's now back in the Autonomous University of Mexico in Mexico City, and myself just pointed out that everything is linear in this parameter. For three dimensions, it's this. For two dimensions, that. And it should work for four dimensions, too. It's basically the surface to volume, which has a long history in nuclear physics, but they are only using this term, basically.
Yeah, but I mean, because connected, there is a the term of curvature energy.
Right.
The binding energy you lose in the border.
Right, so if you're interested, you can look at this old paper.
Then it's no longer linear.
But it works great with clusters, and there have been some work on that. Just a different view, a very general view of looking at clusters versus simple things. And of course, not all of the clusters that you're talking about are the same, but bring that up.
So you said you're talking about like type binding models on the lattice, or is it actually a continuum model with a periodic potential? Or do you recall for the FMOS studies?
So I don't think they can actually be happens. So at this stage I think they can do what you are doing in two body and two body. And for this thing that you're showing now, of course, then if you have a very weakly bound system, right?
That's it works for helium.
Yeah, but
that's a pretty weak.
It has two FMOL states, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, I don't know any. If nobody's tried the scaling for FMOLs.
Yeah.
I don't know if it'll work.
Just thinking, if I get let's say some other one case that there is a patch of violence, so let's again tune to the identity for two. After three already kind of.
What are the assumptions under this thing?
Well,
basically, assume some kind of the liquid.
That there's a
model.
Surface area and a volume.
So
or surface energy, volume energy.
But is it really, like, because, well, as far like my naive understanding of that, like, I think it's not like universal when the bulk properties start if you go from the surface into the bulk. Like, I just talk, for instance, to like...
it's not a sharp boundary, but this assumes it's a sharp boundary.
So you need that there is a minimum number of
Yeah, there's a certain number of atoms on the surface.
You can define
and
an average
atoms in the bulk.
Can you predict, like if you have some surface, like piece of copper, like when like if you go down to the bulk, like when does it start behaving as a bulk?
Yeah, it's when this value is a half. It's one way of saying that.
So it works for that. Although it's not a constant.
Here, this is n for, I think, 114.
Whereas it's much smaller for a two-dimensional problem. And of course, one-dimensional problem is 0.5. Anyway, just something different.
People have computed numerical clusters, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, if you look in the paper, as I said, we have, I think, a plot for helium, a plot for copper, a plot for CO2, a plot for argon, and a plot for alpha particles. So we have 4, 8, 12, and so on, and they fall on a straight line. So you can actually use it to extrapolate or interpolate.
How can you understand the scaling?
What's that?
How can you understand the scaling with M? Is there a simple argument?
Yeah, it's the surface to volume ratio.
Oh, okay.
We did calculations on 2D with helium, and we compared with Monte Carlo, and it's very nice.
Helium is a fantastically accurate example. I think they've done up to 126 when we published this paper back in 86.
126
helium atoms in a cluster.
How do the copper clusters form? Do they hybridize like electronic orbitals?
Yeah, it's a bound.
Because copper kind of sticks out because the rest is like van der Waals cluster. I know about
well, the CO2 is a quadrupole cluster, but
sure. Long range, weakly bound stuff.
No. The alpha particle one is strongly nuclear bound.
Wow. They can predict some.
Yeah.
It's surprising because like
a carbon 12 is strongly bound to nucleus. What's that?
But it's kind of surprising because, well, I talked to some chemists and they told me that it's a really big issue to figure out, like, when really the surface properties change to the bulk properties.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people publish, like, a lot of, you know, science papers and they figure out, like, how it is, like, for water, for instance, because it was, like, a long-standing problem.
We have not done water.
Well, but they figured out that, like, it's, like, only 3 angstrom there. So, like, if you go 3 angstrom down the water surface, it's a bulk already. And they kind of are puzzled about many problems, and it's nice if you can explain them, like,
but yeah, I think that
like retract your science
but,
paper.
But this is giving you the overall, and this doesn't give you the structure. So
yeah,
it
doesn't.
It doesn't give you N of X. It is like this or like that. That is your question. When you are inside the bar, this doesn't.
Right.
You can have many different profiles that you fit the same.
And it really doesn't. I mean, there's an interesting question, which. For example, magnesium or the group 2 alkaline earths in general don't bind each other very strongly. But there's good evidence in magnesium, at least, that magnesium 4 is a relatively strongly bound molecule. So the prediction is that it wouldn't be linear in magnesium. And I think we may have even commented on that, but there were no data for magnesium. That it would have one slope as you went to magnesium 2 and magnesium 3, and then it would jump up. When there was a stronger bump. What?
There are some calculations from Kaplan.
Yeah, I'm sure there are now, but in 86 there weren't any good calculations. And there's also, silver 4 is supposed to be a strongly bound complex also, which is important in photography. That's the smallest nucleation site in film.
Black and white photography.
Yeah. Old-fashioned photography, non-digital.
At the end, you have to transfer it.
It was shown that the manifold expansion diverges. So it doesn't make sense to define three body interactions or four bodies because they are larger than two bodies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this doesn't say anything about three and four body interactions, really. Just that there's a surface and a bulk. And the bulk obviously has a three and four body, and the surface has less three and four body. So, I'm glad it provokes some discussion. So, how about some other, one thing that we've been interested in for a long time are different distances that define short range versus long range. And you talked mainly about the van der Waals distance. Mm-hmm. But there's another interesting distance which is defined mainly by what's called the Leroy criterion for where the singlet and triplet in the alkalis come together, what that distance is. And that depends just on the size of the two atoms, basically, R squared for atom A and R squared for atom B. And then there are larger distances like the retardation distance. And if you're worried about ground states interacting with excited states, there are distances, for example, where the fine structure is small or large. If the fine structure is large, you have C6 interactions. And if it's small, you have for the homonuclear case. And if it's small, then you have a C3 interaction. So there are lots of different, and retardation's been seen experimentally in several experiments in terms of affecting the long-range C3 coefficient.
Yeah, but so probably the error bars of the experiment were for the retardation was included in the error bars.
Well, I don't think so. The experiments are involved with photoassociation of sodium 2. They were done at NIST by Paul Lett.
Yeah, I know the calculation, but the position of the level was not that because I know the Tanya Żelewin now wants to measure
how do you measure retardation? Because, as far as you know, this you could.
Well, the bound state energy levels.
But you compare
if they sample that region.
But you compare it with calculations, which are not
available. Yeah, but. It is Born-Oppenheimer, but you can make. And the lower levels will definitely define what the C3 is or the C6. So if you're looking for the deviation from the.
For helium, for example, in the NIMR, it is the best potentials that fit helium.
Yeah, of course, but the problem is that for helium NIMR, the effect is the strongest. Mm-hmm. But binding energy is about 2 millikelvin, and nobody can measure this binding energy. So computationally, it was proven that the retardation effect is very large, but nobody can measure it.
Mm-hmm. Well, people measure
the only experiment of helium ground state is a Tanya's experiment in which he indirectly proves that this is a bound state by looking at how the dimer behaves in molecular seeds. And then in this way he could get an estimate of the interatomic distance in the dimer. Mm-hmm. But that's the only experimental information that we have.
I
so
think
you,
actually
you
that for
great, there's no spectroscopy of the human diagram.
Well, there's a huge spectroscopy, but not at the ground state.
Yeah.
there was the molecular calipers experiment that we tried that enabled to determine the expectation value.
But you can, like, Wieland does this deflection experiment from like some gratings. See, they don't show the.
That just shows that the dimer definitely exists, and the trimer exists, and the tetramer and so on.
Yeah, but as far as the diffraction and the transmission gradient is concerned, what enters the diffraction pattern is not an ideal one. It's some perturbed by the final dimensions of the bars, the gradient, and the final size of the holes. And the Canadians and the Anchorage called the molecular calipers, because perturbed diffraction pattern reflects actually the relative dimension of the dimer that is passing through the holes and the size of the holes. And so that's how they were able to put a number on the size of these clusters.
Yeah, but
so
you can see. Yeah, but this number is not well defined. I mean, you cannot say that this is the square root of the expectation value of square R, R square. Or raises an expectation value, or
it's a hand-waving argument.
So it increases. Here is experiment increasing in 10%.
Right. Oh, I also that was something that was commented on earlier was that the triplet state of H2 with ground state atoms was the only system that didn't have bound states, but that's not true. Helium-3 dimer does not have bound states. Helium-3, helium-4 does not have bound states. Lithium-6 hydrogen triplet does not have bound states and other isotopes. And I think cesium-helium may not have. I think that's still controversial as to whether or not there's a bound state. What?
Probably. I would guess that it has not.
Well, I think there's a literature where there are arguments both ways.
Well, like the only known system that doesn't have bound states at all, because there are some excited states of things that don't have bound states. Really.
Well, I mean, helium-3 dimer does not have bound states.
In the ground state.
In the ground state. Mm-hmm. And helium-3, helium-4 does.
But you said that hydrogen was like the only known.
No, somebody made that comment.
No, I
mean,
it's interesting. But how about this possible?
But I think actually with hydrogen, that was one of the reasons why people thought of both condensing hydrogen, because they thought there was no bound state. Yeah, and they think, okay, so there's no decay mechanism. Right? So later on it appeared that you could as well use a system which have many bound states. Right? Yeah. And maybe, you know, just to add something on this retardation. So when we do copper channels calculations, we quite often add retardation effects, so the 1 upon R7 part of the tail of the potential. But this only plays a role when you are at the range of maybe beyond 1,000 Bohr units.
Yeah.
So that means that for many of the bond states, it doesn't really matter for the alkalis. It actually matters if you would look, for instance, at Fischbach states, where you tune the scattering length of the same order. So if you make it to 1,000 Bohr units, then you typically have to do an integration which is 5 times this radius,
right,
to make it accurate. And then you really see the difference. But then in the experiment, it's really hard to measure the differences there. And I think for really accurate systems such as cesium and also rubidium, and the retardation on the scattering length when it's not resonant matters something like maybe on the percent level or so.
Yeah.
And that is really hard to measure. But it's definitely interesting just to see the effect.
What about FMOGs? Where's the retardation in FMOGs?
Well, we never include the retardation in
that.
I always I'm not sure. I always thought that the retardation circle was very just larger than that, 1,000 volt. So.
Well, I mean, for the theme of states.
For ground state atoms, right? We're not sure when retardation should start going wrong.
Yeah, you have something like on the order of 1,000.
The wavelength of the resonant light.
Yeah.
Is just 1,000 volt?
Well, in fact, there is a parameter that defines the characteristic length for a particular application. But actually, it's a very important and interesting problem, just because when you look at the C3, so the resonant interactions at the long range, that observation gives you an oscillatory potential. And now, I'm not sure if this is very physical to have like, some oscillations in the very long range, and I think this is the true potential. And all this is derived in the form of an Einhorn approximation, and
you know, it's also
wrong
that what we retardation would do for F morphisms is just that switch a little bit to bind energies, right? So it's just a phase, right? So of course,
yeah, for you it doesn't matter because you use a model potential anyway to simulate a real potential.
So,
I mean, this really matters if you think in terms of using a real potential, right?
Yeah.
And you want to get this as accurate as possible.
No, but that's the whole point, right? We have these model potentials and we nail all the experiments, right? We don't need to have a sophisticated model for the interaction. At least.
But the experiments are usually seeing the lowest FMR state, not the highest.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. So maybe that might be a relevant study. Because we know that, let's say, if you are looking for recombinations and then you start seeing FMR resonances, and they should appear at a ratio of 22.7.
Mm-hmm.
Right, especially the higher ones. And the higher ones, I mean, for the first few ones, you're not going to see 22.7, but for the higher ones.
But then it could play a role, because then you are very weakly bound. And then.
But then if you start getting to the third, fourth resonances.
But then again, you have the same problem. How are you going to measure this, right? You have to go, you know.
I don't remember exactly the estimate, but I think the fourth or fifth FMOC state would be almost microscopic. That's all.
In size?
In size.
Oh, yeah. Even more.
So, so it's a kind of, I don't think it's realistic for experiments to get there. Now, so, I don't know. Well, they can look for those things where the states in a trap, right? You look for particles in a trap. Maybe the energy levels in a trap might be sensitive to retardation too.
Also, what I know you've worked past three particles to four and five, I think. Is there any scaling with n of the FMR states?
Yeah, but there's some funny relationship between body states and FMOF states, right? Mm-hmm. Every FMOF state, there's always a pair of full body states that come together.
Right.
So
can you say something if that is it all, or that you can expect for the four body states in this regime, or could there also be other non-universal states of the same energy, or are they absent?
Well, there's no reason why. There's, you know, there is always a rebound state. I mean, you can have a rebound state, but they're not going to have universal properties. We did one funny calculation.
But those states are they not associated to the Fischbach resonance? I mean, if you or are they? I mean, are there weakly bound four body states which are induced by the Fischbach resonance and which are not related to the Efimov state?
No. We haven't seen any of those before any of the balls. It's always, I mean,
of course, on the negative side, before you form the trimer, you form these two pentamers, and then you form the trimer, and then they follow each other when they scan the S-bar residues. And they, so since there is infinity of F-mol states, you have two times infinity of four body states. Like one ground and the other side.
So what happens with five bodies?
With five bodies, but this work wasn't, I didn't do this work, it was having a whole stacker. You can also find pairs of five body states associated with the lowest tetramer state. Mm-hmm. But then I think he found one excited state for the four bodies, for the five body system, that it was associated with excited. Excited tetramer state.
Okay.
And I think he did also the six body, and found one excited. But you know, it's, it becomes very, very hard.
It sounds like he was sort of, you know, shooting in the dark and finding something.
He was using correlated Gaussians, okay. So he just see energies.
Okay.
So you lose this, the ability of seeing what is happening when you don't have the potential.
Right.
So it's hard to do analysis of this kind of calculation. But...
So are there some really simple model potentials that you could use?
No, he had been using Gaussian potentials,
which
is very convenient for the correlated Gaussian because the integrals are all identical.
Yeah.
Right, so you do stochastic things that save you a lot of time.
So he's finding all of the states in this certain energy region.
He was able to find, to analyze just this tiny part of this paper. So I don't think, I think his paper, he doesn't claim those are the only ones.
Right.
Those are the ones that he found.
Right.
So he might still have more
than
all of this.
Okay.
And I think the Innsbruck recently was kind of claiming to have two of them, just five of them.
In cesium or rubidium?
So are like few body interactions really important there, or I thought because I thought like they've shown that you can describe everything if you use just two body interactions, or I'm saying something
similar. Well, you know, I think we need to be careful with the terminology.
I know people are fighting about that.
Yeah, I mean, two body interactions.
Like not that cannot be represented as a sum of two body interactions.
Yeah.
Just
so I usually think in terms of two body forces. I'm not sure how things to be normal.
I'm thinking chemistry everything is two body kind
of. But she talks about interatomic forces. So if you take into account monadic interactions, you got it for other
So for us, the key thing is that we can describe, we reproduce all this experimental data just using pairwise
interactions.
Okay.
So they don't use axial of
You don't. I mean, I did the calculations including the axial of color, with the realistic numbers, both with the parameters there. Doesn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't do anything. It's very simple. Now, we know that when you go to very short distance, right, the debug forces are really strong. Right, just pairwise there. It's not
useful.
But to reconcile things, you can just look at the two-body potentials and see a repulsive barrier that prevents the atoms when they're coming from 2-3 atoms to actually access the bulk. So that's why
nature doesn't want you to look into that.
What?
Nature doesn't want you to look into that topic.
Well,
it depends on the experiment.
You know, there's
schemes.
So they are somehow not getting there, right? I mean, if you would would have another way of bringing the three particles together at short range? Would this barrier also prevent them from escaping?
Chemically bound trimer.
Yes,
or something.
Yeah. Like a short range. Would this barrier work also the other way around? Because
it would be like
the three particles could be,
or something.
Could be within the barrier. Is that
probably due to room temperature?
But there's not an easy intuition about the process, because we know that the short range is without heat now running into body carriers, and the long range is capacity, except for dipole-dipole interaction, that's the case. But if you take a free-body interaction, then the short range can be attractive, and actually the X-cross direct may be repulsive.
Mm-hmm.
So it's strongly geometry dependent, and there are no rules.
All right.
There's all sort of ideas there.
Mm-hmm. So I think we should hear something from Robert and Michael about what topics didn't get covered yet today that are related to their talks that they'd like to hear more about.
Show that two-dimensional dipolar fermion gas is actually not stable, but spontaneity is from the strike phase without any filtering of the thing. Then a few months ago there was a Monte Carlo simulation which didn't see any of this. So now it's Monte Carlo for fermions is also not really exact because it's fixed mode simulation.
You did like a known group for fermionic dipoles, right?
This exponential answer that you use for bosons, if you would apply it to fermions, it's very widely used in quantum chemistry. So this is the cost of
that. Yeah. It's very similar to the
cost. Yeah.
It's not identical.
Yeah, it's just because you use it in the variational formulation and the cost of that is from non variational.
Yeah.
But the basic idea of
the exponential
and that's very well developed.
Yeah, not just as much as we want to do.
They started the new field physics.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like as everything else.
Or started the new field
physics. Not everything. Not the Born Oppenheimer person. No, didn't start new field physics. Or the Frank Condon.
But Fleischbacher's nonsense.
Yeah,
Although
they didn't do much with it.
Actually,
some people argue. Yeah, I don't know what the dates were. Fano versus Feshbach.
And Feshbach was
in
the
50s, right?
Yeah.
But even students of Fano, like Chris Green and John Bond, refer to them as
Feshbach.
Yeah.
The thing is, somehow that you also mentioned this in 1776, and how did you refer to it?
Because that's what people told me.
That's what people, yeah. And also, Baudouin and Verhaer also had a background in nuclear physics, and he knew it from there.
Yeah.
And then when he
but they are the same
for
the
scheduling.
So Baudouin wanted to mention.
The first molecule notion a little funny. Because you can have Feshbach resonances leading to completely other state that is, very quickly bound states of.
So I was wondering, since some of us will be leaving today or weekend, and just sort of maybe take a stock of the situation, just have a feeling as how this field is evolving, and there is a strong interest in using, output paramount to understand transmatter behavior, interest in quantum simulation, and maybe to some extent, and influence and so I was thinking, maybe if somebody, the broader view as what folks here think how the field may be evolving or developing. So that might be an interesting
Your future.
Yeah, I'm trying to see what are big questions, big broader questions that could be addressed.
How we compete with the quantum computer of Rainer Plasma for the money. Probably, a big issue about could be really to trap, really create cold trap, so polar molecules or non-polar, I don't care, in an optical lattice. So that is the first step, because you can do any simulation or many body thing, you need to create them and show that you can trap them,
and
that there are no chemical reactions or uncontrolled things. For the interest of many ones. Because for the interest of quantum chemistry, you want the reactions. But for this interest, really getting to an experiment with a substantial number of molecules and some other things. That's what one would like to see in the next 5 years.
So would you say that the theory is far ahead of the experiment?
In this sense, yes.
And the thing is, because the experiment is, when were those molecules created? This was 5 years ago or so?
Well, polar, there was a big...
Polar molecules are older than that. Dave didn't know that some of the first experiments...
Yeah, but the ground state...
But they were creating them via...
What's that?
It was 2009 or something, this big year where a few labs created ground states, polar...
In this sense, I would say we need experiments to do things that are not in the theory, to see what we have been missing. Mm-hmm. When we say, you do this, and then blah, blah, blah. You say, no, because you forgot to include whatever effect. So I think in this sense, we need some steps in the experiment.
We made V equals 0 K2 in 2000 in Fitzrath Brothers. Mm-hmm. But those weren't polar.
As I said, for the interest of quantum simulations, creating them, trapping them in a lattice,
taking care of the hyperfine.
For example, when they started experiments of KRB, I think they didn't care if there would be reactions. It was suddenly, what's happening here? I'm losing all the molecules.
Knew that 10 years ago.
Yeah, okay. I didn't. But
just because of
so
the energetics. It's close. It's only 10 wave numbers exo-origic. Mm-hmm. The numbers were sufficiently accurate in 2002,
2003. Okay. When Stokely Monoxide looked at hyperfine, and some of the simulations have been made of deeply controlled quantum gates its platform consisting of a one-dimensional array of Stokely Monoxide molecules. Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of other group 2 metals and oxygen, sulfur, selenium, tellurium, all those words. Yeah, right. So, periodic table's a big place.
just one comment. When you say quantum chemistry, this is a part of chemistry. I am a quantum chemist, and, I built a method to solve the Schrodinger equation for a molecular system, and this is quantum chemistry. But you are talking about chemistry in the quantum regime, So that's a difference.
Like biological physics versus biophysics. The biologists have taken over biophysics, so people are now calling physicists who do biological problems biological physicists.
Or physical chemists, actually.
And physical chemists, physics, that's always overlapped. Bredesdorf and I know that
from way back.
It's really the same thing, but there are different emphases.
Speaking of theory far ahead of experiments, I operator, the creation animation operator, right, on that is always on that is, and go from there. And a lot of the our participants over here actually doing, you know, the mic structure, how they scatter, how they impact C6, C12. And one thing I've always worried is our model is correct. Right? So for example, you know, on lattice, I just write some hypothetical model,
right,
and thinking, well, I have a, so on this potential where I have a molecule, a different potential where I have molecule in the type of type reaction.
Mm-hmm.
But when I talk to people like Paul Julian, you always ask me, what if they say they come to the same cell, right? And outside the interaction, how do you treat that? For example, in my model, should I worry a lot about short-range interactions? Should I model them separately? These kind of questions. These basically, mm-hmm, you know, like you guys educating all these many-body theorists how to write down models. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there, you know, the theory is a very broad term, just like
right,
experiment.
Right.
And one of the major differences is, I mean, quantum chemistry, which Robert represents, can
right,
be
right,
extremely precise in the case of the H2 molecule, for example. But even for large molecules like KRB, they can do a very reasonable job that can guide the experimentalist
right,
in detail. Many of the models, like the Hubbard model in condensed matter physics, are much less accurate and much less founded in fundamental ideas like the Born-Oppenheimer process. So that it's good theory, and it's very interesting theory, and it's not something that the quantum chemist or the AMO experimentalist can do easily. But you know, that's really a very different kind of theory than the kind of theory that Robert does, or Svetlana, or, you know, it's a,
you're saying that they have much more problems apart from short-range interactions. Like it's unaccurate enough.
Yeah.
But actually, these semi-empirical Hamiltonians, like the Hubbard Hamiltonian, they were used in quantum chemistry, but this was in the 50s.
Yeah, but you don't have such strongly correlated systems, right?
Oh, they're very strongly correlated systems.
I think that molecules are the most.
Yeah, they're very.
How many electrons can you treat and how many electrons?
Binding is all correlation. If you sure, don't know the correlation, you don't know the binding.
Yeah, I know, but it's like it's strongly correlated
yeah,
in a different sense.
Yes.
No,
so
no, no.
Because if you consider like how many fermions can people treat on the lattice, and how many electrons can people treat in quantum chemistry, it's incomparable,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but the thing is, if you would ask someone who works on two-body physics, this is IT teaching guy, he says, you know, I am not going beyond two-body physics because it's way too complicated. You know, but
mm-hmm,
the three bodies and four bodies is so terrible because he's thinking in terms of the complete Hamiltonian,
right,
including all the structure.
And
that,
all
that
the
is,
interactions.
That is incredibly complicated to solve
right,
this even for four particle particles,
mm-hmm,
right? And you want to solve many particles, so you have, of course, a simplification which you need,
right,
where you cannot have all those details, right? And you still
right,
want
yeah,
to make a good connection, and that is a hard.
The good news is that the quantum computer does not know that many body problems and problems.
Just do it.
But there's also the question of, like, condensed matter physicists are really interested in measuring order, right? And a chemist would not necessarily be, like, superconducting order, density order. So DFT would be perfectly fine because all you want are single body properties, but DFT would be irrelevant if you wanted to study order in a strongly correlated system. Right? So the tools between the two communities don't really apply to each other.
And I think a lot of the many-body approaches, right? You don't really have, even the right tail of the interaction.
Mm-hmm.
So there are, in all these models, there are kind of compact interactions.
Mm-hmm.
And you might ask if that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
For something like that, it is. As you start digging deeper in the problem, you start maybe all this, the report that's there might be encapsulated some of the parameters.
Yeah, so I'm asking because new scale vendors, because you say, you know, that polar gas is trapped in their creation properties. You Hamiltonian is well known, I have to say. But then, like what Michael talked about the other day, when you add the lattice, you have another energy scale, right? That is spacing of this. And then, how many bands should it be equal? Right? Depending on your interaction, right? And depending, then your model is not going to be, say, a single band top of the model modified to take into account the non-ranging interaction, like all the molecules. Maybe you need to write much more complicated stuff in interband coupling, and if you don't even talk about it, it's probably this not proper. You are most interested in fish for dozens. Even fish for dipolar induction, I believe we have to be very, very careful. Even the tunneling from one well to the other, you have deep lattice limit, shallow lattice limit.
Right.
But that's the thing that, you know, can be worried sometimes.
Well, and I mean, another interesting thing to think about is that all the particles we're talking about are composite particles.
Right.
They're made up of fermions, but they're not. So for example, if you think about a diatomic molecule like rubidium, Rb2, it also has states that are primarily Rb plus, Rb minus. Rb plus and Rb minus would not have the same fundamental symmetry as Rb. So do we have a pair of bosons or a pair of fermions? If we're asymptotically in Rb plus and Rb minus, and a millikelvin away is Rb plus Rb in some excited state.
Yeah, but it was like one of this famous paper by George Shlapnikov, I think. I mean, it's somewhat related, like the stability of this boson molecules formed out of two fermions, because if they're long range, you cannot really tell which one it is.
It's that same idea. It's an interesting question.
Yeah.
I don't know the solution.
Yes.
It's very nice because all of a sudden we get a lot of avoided crossings.
Right.
And so where you see the squamp.
Right. But if you think of it in the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, that's fine. They're not different particles.
That is sort of somewhat, you know, in these femtosecond experiments of Lamont Ziegler, like the simple modified sodium iron.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, but you're not saying this is a boson and that's a fermion.
A question for Robert and Paula. I hope the distinction is important to understand chemistry of the machine. What about the H plus plus H2 reaction of thermal energies? What is actually the role of thermal? Because the main distinction, I think, in the two chemistries is the occurrence of thermal.
There was the most recent paper I was aware of was published in PRO about a year ago. Couple of years ago, anything happened. Proton plus H2, sorry.
Proton plus H2.
Yeah, okay, what are you asking?
Well, that's also.
In the neutral.
H plus H2.
For neutral hydrogen plus H2, I mean, you know that there have been, you know, so much studies, calculations, but there are my theories.
But this is a barrier.
There is some
barrier less, but the neutral hydrogen plus H2 has a barrier of half an eV for the exchange. But you know, so much calculations have been done, but no experiments. I think it is significant.
It's significant.
It's
kind of standard for the machines.
It is.
Right.
Same fluorine plus H2.
Right.
H plus H2 is like, so all tunneling below half an AV of
is a new piece of work that is there actually, like an H plus H2 experiment.
So, are there any other interesting questions we want to discuss today, or how long do you want to go on? Ask a question if you want us to stay, and if you don't, if that's a question, we'll leave in 1 minute.